Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture: luxury ice, and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy, actually, for the bikes to sting upside down or slip or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Yuki Minakawa, beverage and service director at Sushi Ginza Onodera in New York City, which has 2 Michelin stars. And Yuki has worked in some of the New York City's top Japanese restaurants, such as Masa and Japanese Brasserie and Kajitsu. She started in front of house positions before becoming a certified sake sommelier and diving into the world of cocktails. Sushi restaurants used to offer Japanese beer and sake only, but now you can find interesting pairings with a diverse range of beverages, including cocktails, spirits, and wine. So today we'll discuss Yuki's interesting background. She's from Brazil, by the way, and can speak 4 different languages. And how she has built a career as a beverage expert, what to pair with Japanese cuisine, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Now let's start our conversation with Yuki Minaka. Hello, Yuki. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure being here with you.
So, yes. So, let's talk about your background first because this is so interesting. So, I heard that you were born and grew up in Brazil and... Of course, as I said earlier, you are fluent in Japanese, Portuguese, Spanish, and English. So tell us about your childhood, how you grew up, and your life in Brazil.
So I was born and raised in Brazil. I was born in Brasilia, the capital, but I moved to Rio when I was very, very... It was a baby still. It was about 2 months old, and I stayed in Rio until I was 10. Then I went back to Brasilia when I was 10 and stayed there until I was 17 before I went to Japan.
Oh, wow.
So in Brazil, I would say that I grew up mainly with my mother. My mother's Brazilian, so I grew up with the Brazilian culture mainly, eating rice and beans, having in my house was a very specific one, everything we had in a week. So every week we definitely had a cow liver, we had that I hated.
Now
I love it. But when I was a child, it was a little bit of a challenge. But then every day we had something different, a chicken, fish, meat. And the weekends we had like lasagna, stroganoff. And my mom used to create like very fun dishes that children used to like. And basically I grew up mostly with the Brazilian culture on food. And having a Japanese dad, little by little it was introduced to me, the Japanese food. But in Brazil, the thing we ate mostly as fun was the instant ramen.
I don't blame you. Right. Wow, that's interesting. So, and it's interesting, you are totally in the world of Japanese cuisine.
Yes.
Every day. So, okay. So, you used to be a fashion model as well. And I can tell. Too bad the listeners can see you. So how did you, did that career start and develop as a model?
I started modeling when I was about 14 in Brazil, actually in Brasilia, for like events and some like very specific special commercials. I always been more of a video person than a picture person. But in Brasilia, being the capital and being the place where the government is, we have a lot of like very special government parties where they need people to be at the front and greet the customers and or the politics and bring it inside. Or even when we had the tennis competition inside Brasilia, I was one of the persons that greet the players at the airport, made sure they were guided to the right place, and did things like that. When I was about 15, I participated in a modeling competition called the Look of the Year from Elite Models. So I did that when I was 15. When I was 16, I got fifth place in the national, and I was invited to go to Japan.
Wow.
But it was before I finished high school, so my mom said no. And she said, you only would be able to go after high school. So when 17, I finished high school, I packed my bags and went to Japan to become a model.
Yes. Well, it sounds like your current career to, you know, be faced with customers, diverse, different kinds of customers, and introduce great beverages to them. That sounds like your career started when you were already 14 years old.
Yes. I definitely, my customer service and understanding people and being able to interact with them, it came with me in a very early age.
Wow. So you said you went to Japan when you were 17. So you were modeling when you were there?
Yes, I was there. I arrived in Japan when I was 17 in January. It was extremely cold. It was actually a snow day, and it really surprised me. I never thought Tokyo was snow. And Tokyo greeted me with a beautiful snow. And I stayed there 15 years working as a model.
Wow.
Being one of the top models of my agency. Did a lot of commercials for a lot of big brands.
Right. Wow. So did you enjoy life in Tokyo?
Tokyo is amazing. It's real. Tokyo gave me the chance to be introduced to everything. I got there when I was 17. So in food-wise, everything was introduced to me in Tokyo. My first Japanese curry was in Tokyo. My first lobster was in Tokyo. Natto. I wouldn't say sushi and sashimi because of my father, I had a little bit of contact with, but I never really ate. Nowadays, I just love Japanese cuisine incredibly, yes.
So you are really building up your career towards what you're doing right now, sounds like. And so you moved to New York City in 2008. So what made you to move back to New York?
So in 2008, what happened was my ex boyfriend at that time, now my ex, we met in Japan. We moved to Brazil together. He actually got a job in Brazil, but his training was here in New York. So he came to train in New York. The company liked him so much and asked him to move to New York. And when he moved, I ended up moving with him.
So that sounds like a destiny.
Yes.
And you never left.
And I never left. We broke up. He went back. He was actually not American. He was Colombian. He went back to Colombia and I stayed in New York.
What's the reason for that? Did you... You know, everybody has different reasons to stay in New York, right? So what is your reason?
Mine was my career, definitely. Because of him, I came and I was trying to pursue modeling at that time in 2008, but it was the age, the working permit problem, all of that. I couldn't pursue modeling, and my skill beside modeling was speaking Japanese and having a very strong customer service background. So I decided to approach a Japanese restaurant and try to work with them. And I got a job, and that's how my career started here in New York.
Mm. So I heard that the first place you started working was at Soba Toto in the Midtown.
Yes.
Right. So I know the soba chef that back then was Shuichi Kotani.
Yes, that was my first chef that I ever have a pleasure to work with. And I was hired to be a hostess at Soba Toto. I hosted there for about 4 months, and immediately they made me an assistant manager.
So you must be really good naturally. You've been trained for doing that even.
I believe so. I believe my whole training from modeling time and customer service and understanding very difficult clients came from a very early age.
So over the last 10 years or so, you've been immersed in the Japanese restaurant industry in New York City. So before, after Soba Toto and before Sushi Ginza Onodera, which is your current job, what kind of places did you work?
After Soba Toto, I was a wine consultant for Winebo. I actually sold wine, and I help bring wines to Japanese customers or to Japanese restaurants. And Winebo had a sake portfolio, so we got sake in Western restaurants and wine in Japanese restaurants. After Winebo, I was thinking what to do, if I should pursue my wine career or my sake career, and I decided for sake as being half Japanese, and at that time it was lacking the sake sommeliers on the floor in the restaurants. So then I decided to work in Decibel to learn.
Right.
So I did Decibel for sake, and Momokawa, the shabu shabu place, I work with wine.
Right. So just for, this is a lot going on here. So when you started working with Winebo, Winebo is one of the, in my opinion, you know, very boutique, really good section of brands. And you studied wine at that point already?
Yes. So when I got into Winebo, they had a very nice educational program, and we studied basically every week. We had a class. We had what we call like a meeting with the suppliers, and I learned a lot from them, and I developed my wine knowledge. I started already at Soba Toto because I used to do all the lists for them, but with Winebo I got a little bit more deep into. And I at that time did the ASA foundation course, so the American Sommelier Association foundation course. Of course, thinking always to pursue and do the second and third level of wine.
Right. So that makes sense. Now you're in charge of everything, wine list, sake list, and cocktails at Sushi Ginza Onodera. Okay. So, let's, you said, you know, the sake bar Decibel, that's kind of a shrine of sake.
Yes.
Right? It's a very old place, but they have, I think it's about 100 sake.
At the time that I worked with them, we had about 78 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
Sakagura, that's a sister restaurant, they always have way more than 100. But our storage was a little smaller. Clientele was a little bit different. But I believe now they probably have about 100.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they were getting a little bit more space to get a little bit more sake for choices for the customers.
This smells interesting. It's kind of like in the Midtown, and you could just pass. And then
Decibel?
Decibel.
It's the village.
Oh, that's
yes,
sorry.
It's the village.
Oh, that's
yes.
A Decibel. Well, but you know, sorry. The Decibel, you pass by and then like, wow.
You don't
it's
know.
Kind of like a downstairs-ish, right?
Yes, it's downstairs. It's I always say it's a little hole in the wall. But you want to have fun and you want to enjoy like and a variety of different sakes for a very reasonable price. I think Decibel is one of the best choices.
Yeah, it's almost like a community or some kind of very intimate ambience.
It's where all the sake geeks go, right, in that way. And everybody in the industry, after work, Sesebel is one of the places that probably it's open until a little bit late. Mm. So we end up there drinking sake.
Right. So you really started from the very deep place.
Oh, yes. Right.
And also you worked at the N Japanese Brasserie and Masa Kajitsu. So what kind of experience did you have at each place?
So N Japanese Brasserie, I was a bartender there. Before that, I was helping a shochu brand called Mizunomai to develop. So I really, really got in contact with a lot of mixologists and bartenders. Mm.
Jesse, founder of Mizunomai, came here a long time ago, but he's amazing.
Yes, yes. So Jesse Followitz, yes. Right. When he first started Mizunomai, we started together. I helped him in the first steps of developing his brand. Mm. And meeting all the mixologists and bartenders and being in that world, it got my mind so fascinated with the cocktail and cocktail environment and industry. So when I had the chance to work at N Japanese Brasserie and they offered me the position of being a bartender, I embraced it with all my heart. Mm. And I learned as much as possible from every single person that was working there and getting every single tip and advice from all my friends that are bartenders and mixologists. Mm. So N Japanese Brasserie, beside having a lot of very high celebrities that goes there, that really, really actors and actresses and models and supermodels that I grew up watching, having the Chef Abe with the amazing way that he developed his cuisine, mm, and being capable of contributing in his and their cocktail program, that was a fascinating time.
Mm.
And after N Japanese Brasserie, that's when I got my certification as a kikizakeshi, as a sake sommelier. It was 2014, and that time I got an offer to work with Chef Masa at Masa, in
Time Warner Building.
In Time Warner Building, and mm-hmm, that was not a second thought of going my next level, and it was very scary. But I learned everything I learned on high end restaurant. I would say I learned at Masa.
Mm. Well, I hear the Masa could be the most expensive Japanese restaurant in the whole country. So, super, yes, high-end, and all those big fans of Masa's cuisine. So, wow. And then you went to Kajitsu. That's the vegetarian, yes, traditional Japanese kaiseki restaurant.
So, right? Kajitsu is a Buddhist cuisine, and mainly vegan upstairs. And we have Kokage downstairs that's a non-vegetarian. So, Kajitsu, just to meet the Zen side of Japan and the beauty of Kyoto Kaiseki style and the high quality ingredients and the way they develop every single sauce from scratch because it has to be vegan. That was also very fascinating for me. And be capable of pairing with very high-end sakes and their beautiful cuisine. That was actually my first restaurant where I put it myself out of the box and I decided to create a premium sake pairing,
mm,
where I opened bottles that we used to sell up to $500 and giving the customers that opportunity to drink an ounce and a half with the pairing, with the cuisine, with the kaiseki, with the courses.
Mm.
So that was a little bit, just a little scary, but we end up having an amazing success, mm, with the new premium pairing at Kajitsu.
Right, that's how you educate people to the next level, right? Because once you have a really good one, you remember it.
And then you have that choice of depends on your cuisine, because it's not that an expensive sake is not good. It's, every sake to me is amazing. But when you have that choice, oh, today I'll have a little bit more of a high end and I know what I want to have.
Mm.
And then today, you know, I'm like I'm in a pizza place. I want to have sake with pizza, and you can actually do it.
Mm.
So if you, idea is always to educate my customer as much as I can.
Mm.
And I also, in Kajitsu, I created a cocktail program without using any type of spirits.
Oh, wow.
Yes, they didn't care any spirits, only wine, beer, and sake. So I had to play a lot and being capable of creating a cocktail program that didn't use vodkas, gins, any type of spirits.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Well, that means that it tend to be low alcohol.
Yes, definitely.
Right, by definition, because it can go beyond.
It's impossible to go higher.
Right. Oh, that's great. So because you could pair the kind of cocktails with food even.
Definitely, definitely. I think that's the best type of cocktails that you can do with food. If you get a lot of spirits, your buds, depends on the food that you have, your taste buds will be a little compromised for sure.
Because with alcohol.
Because the high alcohol will mask a lot of, will numb a little bit your taste buds in a way, and will mask a lot of the flavors that you can actually enjoy if you just do like a very low alcohol cocktail.
Interesting. Right. So after that you worked at Nodal, which is another super high end restaurant. And then so came to Sushi Giza Nodal. So what happened?
I was at Noda for a very short time. It was just only 5 months. I just helped them open the restaurant and develop their service style and their list. And Chef Saito, that used to be our chef at Sushi Ginza Nodera, he's always been wanting to work with me. And he was actually my door to get inside Sushi Ginza Nodera. And yes, it's always been my... I was very interested in working in a type of sushi like Sushi Ginza Onodera.
Right. Okay, so we're going to get into the Sushi Ginza Onodera's food in a moment. But so how do you characterize the New York City Japanese restaurant culture versus the Japanese restaurant culture in Japan? Because you spent 15 years in Japan, right? So how do you compare?
When I was in Japan, because I was more on the modeling side, I didn't really pay so much attention on what was the restaurant industry there. But as a customer being there and as being with a very interesting group, because modeling, we have photographers, stylists, makeup artists, and people that travel over the world. I'll tell you, the gastronomy in Japan, it is one of the top in the world, for sure. Japanese has a passion for food, has a passion for new taste, and they are very open-minded to taste new things. And I see the Japanese will try to put it their twist and their elegance and their subtleness, because Japanese food, it has a very nice elegance and subtleness to it. Compared to New York, I would say that New York right now, it's getting way, way more on a gastronomy side that used before, mostly because I think a lot of people are more open up for new flavors and taste. Something that I didn't see so much before. But now I see that people challenge and will taste something that's a little bit more fishy on a sushi side, or something that normally they would not do it in a normal environment.
So maybe all those social media on the internet information is helping to increase that curiosity and actual courage.
Yes, definitely, definitely. It's really pushing, especially the way people take pictures, the way the pictures come out, and it gets people to really want to eat it and taste and then try and give their opinion on the flavors of the new food in a way.
Yes. It's interesting, right? The restaurants are sometimes critical of customers taking pictures, but it's actually raising the bar of the whole culinary world globally.
It's being able to see same dish from many different eyes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, now that the technology is so advanced that some movies are made by iPhone.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm not, into the taking pictures and without conversation. That's not what it is, but I think it's good to have, awareness of the restaurants. It's being seen and people appreciate it, and I get the share of that evidence of how good it is. I don't think it's not bad at all to have pictures taken. So anyways, you kind of mentioned how you learned about, the sake and shochu, cocktail wine, and knowledge, but how hard was it? Because you were curious about all those things, so you naturally absorbed what you wanted to.
I think that really goes on my, I guess, my Japanese side. I need to know everything to be comfortable, to be prepared. Mm-hmm. Study something I've been doing for 11 years now. I haven't stopped studying. My plan this year maybe is to do the wine course and becoming a wine sommelier also. But I've been studying and I've been trying to get information online through suppliers, through brewers owners, through the sommeliers there. I've been doing this job way ahead than me. So I'm always trying to learn as much as I can. Mm. If you say hard or easy, it's fun for me, so I don't see so hard, and I'm very hard on myself. But it is a process. It's been 11 years, or all I know from every single person and every single information that I get.
Mm. Right. So the curiosity, but I imagine though that you kind of study for your customers.
Yes.
Right? So that you can tell the stories and something fun about what you serve.
It's so much passion that I have with beverage that comes out when I talk to customers. And having the story of the background of who makes and how he makes, not all the customers are interested in hearing, but a lot of customers are very interested to know, and makes a difference. Like before, they were only interested about the polish ratio of the rice, but nowadays they want to know why this gentleman made the sake in this way. So it's a lot of fun for me to be capable of talking to customers that way.
Right.
Yes, and educate them as much as possible.
Mm. What about, you know, for instance, sake breweries, you know, number of breweries are declining. And I think, you know, whatever the wine or sake or shochu, whenever I see in person the producers, I feel like, oh, I have to support them. And you tell the story. And do you think it's important for, you know, the producers to come to the States or whatever the market is and speak to the local, you know, sommeliers and the customers?
Oh, definitely, definitely. There's a lot of information that's not listed, that's not shown on online, or the suppliers are not really has to give us. So being capable and talking to the producers, to the brewers owners, to the tojis, to the makers, it's very mind-opening in a way. And little by little, you have more questions and things that they don't think they have to give the information to customers or to us, that sommeliers that wants to sell their product. And also it's very important because then I know why they make the way they make their concept, their philosophy, the way they want to sell it, why they want to sell it that way. That's very important because at the end of the day, it's their product. And I need to respect completely what do they want to pass to their customer.
Mm.
So I'm kind of the middleman. I'm the information and the translator a little bit between the brewers, the winemakers, and the sake makers to the customers.
Mm. So what's the best way? You know, there are trade shows, but is that the most effective way to sell? Or they should come independently and visit different kinds of restaurants and bars and meet?
If they can come individually and visit, that's much better for us because then we will have like a whole year of people coming. I know the shows, everybody comes at the same time, and it's becoming very hard because there's so many people to see and so many restaurants to go, that when they come little by little, that's much easier. We had an event last week at Sushi Ginza Onodera with a producer, and it was very mind-opening seeing how much the customer got excited to be capable of talking to him.
Mm.
They were amazed by being able to shake his hand, talking to him, and ask their questions directly. So doing that event at Sushi Gizondera, to me, it was a very mind-opening for the future ways to educate customers.
Mm. Right. Oh, no, especially someone like you who can speak Japanese and English. And I know that sake brewers tend to have no idea, especially because of Japanese language barrier. And, you know, most of them have not been to New York or big markets. Is there's a, you know, kind of like challenges mentally before they try to even come? to the market. So
yes, so I try to get that distance a little bit less between them and the customers.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, hopefully there are going to be more sommeliers like you.
I hope so too.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss what beverage we should pair with sushi. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio has plenty more. Hi, I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I'm the host of Feast Your Ears here on HRN. My show explores the world of food through storytelling. Every week, I talk with people inside and outside the food world about how experience has shaped what they eat and cook. You can find Feast Your Ears wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Yuki Minakawa, who is the beverage and service director of Sushi Ginza Onodera in New York City, which has 2 Michelin stars. So now let's talk about what you do now.
Yes.
So what is Sushi Ginza Onodera?
Okay, so Sushi Ginza Onodera, our concept is from Ginza to the world. And it's actually written on our website. We're serving quality Edomai-style traditional sushi with fish imported from Toyosu Fish Market and Niigata Prefecture rice tinted in red vinegar. So basically, that's what we are. We are Edomai-style sushi.
Right. And it's funny, right? So Tsukiji moved, so it's now new Toyosu Market.
Toyosu Market,
right.
Yes.
Okay. So what kind of menu do you serve? Like, you know, lunch and dinner, they have 2 services, right?
Yes. So we have 2 services, lunch and dinner. Lunch, we have 2 seatings, one at 12 o'clock and 1:30. And we have 3 different type of omakase style. We have 10 pieces style, 13 pieces style, and 15 pieces style. Mm-hmm. So lunch, it's very for anyone that really want to taste our sushi and doesn't want to spend that much. Mm-hmm. So you get 1 appetizer, 10 pieces, 1 appetizer, 13 pieces, or 1 appetizer and 15 pieces for lunchtime. Of course, follow with miso soup, dessert, and tea.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and for dinner?
For dinner, we have 2 different type of omakase. We have our seasonal omakase that comes with 5 appetizers, 10 pieces of sushi, miso soup, dessert, and tea. And with our seasonal, you do have a choice to add some supplement courses that normally it's served in our premium. So we have a premium kiwami, 7 appetizers, 10 pieces of sushi, miso soup, dessert, and tea. And those 2 appetizers you can actually order as a supplement course on our season omakase.
Mm, right, beautiful. So it's not cheap. You know, it's cheaper than masa. So for dinner, you have like $300 and $400. But I'm sure that's really worth it. That's the whole thing about craftsmanship and the best pieces, kind of fish and the service, not to mention, and the sushi chef's skills, which was accumulated over years and years. So that's the Sushi Ginza Onodera. And where is it located?
We are located in 461 Fifth Avenue, just across the street from New York Library.
Mm, beautiful. Okay, so, by the way, this Ginza Onodera is a brand and which has 11 restaurants in 7 cities worldwide, and including London, Paris, Shanghai, and LA. And
Hawaii.
And Hawaii, too.
Yes. Ah.
And the categories of, it's wide range, sushi, teppanyaki, tempura. And it's not just that. It operates a diverse range of businesses, including food services at the hospitals, schools, sports facilities, and even a sushi school.
Yes.
So I was a little curious about this sushi school thing. It's called the Onodera Sushi Academy.
Yes.
In Tokyo. So what is it?
So Onodera Group has four different companies underneath, and one of the companies is called PW Holdings. It operates our language schools in some Asian countries and also in Hawaii. And PW right now has our Sushi Academy School, where we'll be capable of teaching the young chefs or the young cooks that would like to become a sushi chef. And then we'll bring them to our restaurants also, and they can start it already there. So right now we are doing the academy for about a year. And right now we do not have English language courses, only in Japanese. But we more than welcome any foreigner, non-Japanese chef or cook that would like to learn sushi that speaks Japanese.
Mm.
But the next step, the next way, the next level, it will be to make our sushi classes also in English.
Mm. Yeah, I was curious. So on the website, it says the maximum 18 students and there are three teachers. So it's almost like private classes, no? Six students per teacher, and 3 months,
yes,
and 60 classes. So, and it's just so smart because, you know, the sushi is really popular, and I always often get asked, do you know any good sushi chefs I can hire? It's like, no, there are not so many available. So what they're doing is they're really making sure they have the best supply of well-trained chef who can work for the restaurant that they operate.
Yes.
Outside Japan. So yes. I think it's really smart.
Yes, yes. Because it's the develop of a sushi chef, it's many, many years. So they are trying to find a very efficient and practical and a faster way to get the cooks and the chefs in practice.
Right. And also, it's almost for good students, it's guaranteed to get a job on graduation.
Definitely, definitely.
Right.
Yeah, definitely they'll definitely have competitions inside where who's going to go to Hawaii, who's going to go to LA, who's going to stay in Japan. But most of the students will go through first the Sushi Ginza Onodera in Japan before departing to different countries.
Right. That's interesting. Okay. So, all right. So let's go back to Sushi Ginza Onodera, New York. So you are the beverage and service director of the restaurant. So what kind of beverage menus do you have?
We have everything. So we have champagne, wine, cocktails, beer, whiskey, shochu, sake, of course. We have everything. We have a full bar at the restaurant.
Mm. So what kind of customers do you have?
Our customers is a variety. Being in Fifth Avenue, definitely get a lot of tourists that will come. We have a lot of people that come as a destination that already knows they want to come to Sushi Ginza Onodera specifically. We do have a lot of regulars. But I see when it comes to different nationalities, I see a lot of Brazilians there. Hmm. I see a lot of Chinese.
Brazilian because you are inviting them?
I wish I would have taken the credit for that, but nope, not me.
Interesting.
Yeah, they do have like, I think it's a couple offices around there that mainly Brazilian workers. And they start coming for lunch and they love our sushi so much, they end up coming for dinner too and bring their wives, their spouses, yes.
Right, so among those, you know, diverse clients, what kind of beverage or, you know, any preference mostly ordered by them?
I would say the Brazilian goes for the sake for sure right away. Yes. Sake is always a big choice between among our customers, but I do have a lot of Asians that like to have like a light cocktail, just a little bit. A lot of people don't drink that much, so they'll choose like a light cocktail, and then they have specific pairings that it goes to a specific nationality. For example, Japanese will do torizu biru, so it starts with a beer.
Yeah. Oh, let's talk about this. You know, it's so funny, right? So when people dine out in this country, like in New York. You know, it's just, go out, so let's have a glass of cocktail first. But then in Japan, like, sit down, let's have a beer.
Yes.
No question.
Yeah, beer is water for Japanese.
I don't know where the habit comes from.
I guess from like all the salarymen getting together after work and doing their little cheers, I guess beer is the easiest thing to drink and is a way to just quench your thirst, because beer is made to quench your thirst.
Right.
Yes. And I think they view that as water.
Right. Yes. So, toriazu biru.
So, Japanese will start with a beer. Sometimes they will start with a glass of champagne, but then they'll go for sake. And Japanese love having Bordeaux with sushi. So they do have, yes.
Interesting.
Yes, they really like having a very nice, bold Bordeaux with sushi.
Do you think it's because of the tannins in Bordeaux grapes?
I think the Japanese love the fish, the really flavor of the fish. And some fish really, they really brings the more of the fishiness when you have with a Bordeaux wine, while and a different, like, let's say any or like a non-Japanese will do like maybe a Sancerre, that's a type of wine that's very sharp to break the fat of a fish. Mm. Japanese would want to enhance that
the
oiliness,
fishiness. The fishiness. Interesting. Yes.
And Chinese, high-end Chinese, let's say, that want to spend a little bit more, they love doing old Pinot Noir with Toro.
Mm.
And I love that combination. I think it goes really well, especially if you chill your Pinot Noir a little bit, without being room temperature, and you have with like a nice piece of like a Toro, it really goes well.
I kind of sense it, because Pinot Noir has some bloody, you know, like irony taste, right? So that comes almost like a blood in Toro.
The Pinot Noir has a very nice acidity too. So the acidity will break the fat from the Toro. Mm. And that combination of flavors, it enhances the flavor of the fish.
Mm. Yes. Well, that, you know, the Bordeaux and the fish pairing is a good lesson. It enhances the fishiness. But if you are into those flavor, you should.
You should do it, yes.
Right. And things like Riesling, some people like Riesling, dry Riesling.
Yes, I love dry Riesling, and dry Riesling definitely with the sushi goes extremely well, especially some dishes that's a little bit more on a fat, not creamy. Let's say, I'll put Riesling and Chablis almost in the same category, with oysters, with scallops, that will go really well, with a light fish, with a little bit, from light to medium fish, I think goes really well.
Mm. So, but in general, would you suggest white wine with sushi?
Well, if you were, if you want to, we'll say, if you're not too familiar with wines, I think the white will be the best way to start. I wouldn't go too sharp, like a Sancerre. I would do maybe a Bordeaux Blanc, that's like a Sauvignon Blanc Semillon. It's a little bit more on around the way.
Mm.
Or very nice, like light Chardonnay, Burgundy Chardonnay. That's probably what I would have started with, someone that's just starting to pairing the sushi and fish, yes.
Right. And naturally, you know, I've done parallel pairing, you know, like a glass of white and the sake with sushi. I just like, you know, tasting setting. And it depends on what kind of sake and wine, but sake is forgiving. So it's easier to make a mistake, but it's okay. You are not making mistake, that kind of thing.
I would say I always find so much easier to pair sake with anything, because sake doesn't have so much acidity, so it doesn't fight so much. Mm. I always find a little bit harder with wine than with sake.
So that's the key is the acidity.
Yes, the acidity. You can play, when you do pairing, you can do two things. You can combine two flavors or you can go against. Mm. The acidity works a lot or as a, like a palate cleanser in a way. So it cleans up a little bit your palate, breaks fat, enhances like sweetness, things like that. So acidity definitely it's one of the keys for pairing.
Mm. Right. And also another thing about sake is even if it's dry in terms of, you know, the sugar contents, it tastes sweeter or some rounded fruitiness.
Sake, it's rice. So rice is sweet. So definitely you always get, it, even if it's just a touch, you always get a touch of sweet on sake for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. So does it help to pair with different kinds of food?
It can help or you can really throw you off in a way. Yes, but I haven't been wrong much on my sake pairings, and I always get the help of all my customers when I do a sake pairing for them. I make sure that I ask, what do you think? Everybody's palate is different, everybody's idea is different. So I did have a couple pairings that I did that a customer told me, don't do it again.
Okay, right. So what's the taboo on choosing sake with a certain kind of food?
I try to find a very interesting, like I try to find what is in the food that I want to enhance. For example, we have a hairy crab dish at Onodera, and I always pair with a Myosakai Tenmi. And I do believe that sweetness from the crab and the touch of sweetness that we get from the Mitsui Matsuyama rice from Myosakai Tenmi, it just really, really blends together amazingly. So I try to find the point on the food that I want to enhance and the point of the sake that I want to enhance, and then I try to put them together.
So that's the people say they're complements or contrasts. So yes, that's the complement side.
That's the complement side.
Right.
Contrast side, I think I work more when you say, let's a mackerel, a saba, because it's extremely fishy, a lot of oil.
Mm.
And if it's non-Japanese, then I want to break that fat. I want to make sure that's gone. So I get a very dry sake and I pair with. Let's say we have one at the Onodera called Yuki Otoko, is a Jumai sake. That's a plus 12, so it's extremely dry. When I pair that with saba, I get a lot of happiness from my customers, for sure.
Okay.
But if I want to enhance that oiliness, then maybe I'll do a taro sake. And then the taro sake, the flavor of the wood with the oiliness of the saba and the roundness, I think that will combine.
So taro sake basically is an oak-aged sake.
It's a cedar.
Cedar-aged
sake, yes.
So the rule is, if you don't like fishy stuff, get the dry sake.
Yes.
But the dryness is usually on the back label, right?
Most of the sakes now, they all listed. And you can always ask your sake sommelier at the restaurant, in any restaurant. They will know your portfolio much more.
Mm-hmm.
So the portfolio of the restaurant, so they will definitely will know which sake will be the driest and which one will be the sweetest.
Right.
And definitely, if you don't like that fishiness, go for the dry sake, that you will be much happier. But I was don't forget that you have other fish it comes with.
Mm.
So you need to balance too. I would say like get one glass for the fishiness and get maybe like a nice bottle for everything else.
Yes. Interesting. Right, that's a good advice. Yeah, because it's you know, that each sushi piece has completely different personalities, so it's very hard. But yeah, so what's the most forgiving item though, sake or wine? And if you have to order one bottle of something at the restaurant, at the sushi restaurant,
I'll tell you, go for your preference because you never go wrong. So that's for sure. So if somebody is not used to sake and order a bottle of sake, it might not be a very good idea, only if you decide to be challenged.
Mm.
But yeah, I would say go for your preference first. And if you want to, like if you want to adventure and try something new, get a glass first.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, talk to your sommelier, see exactly where, because your first impression is going to be very, very strong. So you want to make sure that first impression will be taken in a very nice way.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you can have one moment of what is, you know, the synergy between this wine or sake or anything with the piece of sushi, and you just stop talking
Yes.
You know, that kind of, if you have that moment at least once per dinner, I think you're good. You're going to keep learning. Right. Okay, so I'm going to talk about your cocktails too. So you are, you concoct different unique cocktails. So give me an example of what kind of uniqueness you have.
So I like to play a lot with my cocktails, and I try to make my bases at the house. So we do have one called the Cranberry Kiss. Our Cranberry Kiss is basically just a normal cranberry vodka, but I made the made the cranberry inside the house. So I make sure that it has a little bit more of freshness of the cranberry, a touch more of sweetness, and I know exactly everything that's inside. So it's no preservative, that's nothing. It's made, it's kept it in the refrigerator for like 3-4 days, and then we will make another batch. Mm-hmm. I put it a little bit of cinnamon with, so I can give a little bit of earthiness so that's, with that cocktail. So it's just a little twist of our normal cranberry vodka. And I do have another one that it's I really like. It's my one of my favorites, called Namida. And Namida is actually the fresh wasabi that you have in the omakase restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I get that fresh wasabi and I infuse in Suntory, the new Suntory vodka. And I let it sit and make a wasabi vodka. And I created a martini out of it.
That's the haku.
Haku, yes,
I tasted it. It was really rice vodka.
Yes, yes. Right. And it's very light in a way. So even though it's a martini, it's not going to have a punch, but it does have wasabi. Mm. But fresh wasabi is not extremely spicy. It does have a touch of sweetness. Mm. So I think those two right now is my favorite in a way that you can actually enjoy with food.
Right, because the sushi rice with wasabi, that's a parallel of that cocktail.
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. I have to come and drink.
You have to.
Right. Okay. So, so you've worked in a Japanese restaurant industry for over 10 years now. So do you see any trend?
Like we talked before, I think customers are more open to new flavors. And I would say food-wise, I think customers are just more open for new flavors. Before omakase, it like a saba or like a sama, like a little bit more of a fishy type of fish, it was not very welcome by a lot of people. Nowadays, people actually go after those. Mm. So I think the buds and the flavor development in the palate is actually improving and growing for sure.
Interesting. Because yes. I think the current customer generation is the generation, first generation, whose parents are eating sushi very often. So they are born with sushi.
Yes, yes. I've seen babies picking up a piece of sashimi with no soy sauce and munching out in a way that I find amazing.
Right.
Yes.
And it's good for the baby.
Yes, it's good for the baby for sure. Yes.
Right. Okay. So, so what's your plan?
Ooh, my plan. So this year, I'm already a sake sommelier, certified shochu advisor, and I will pursue my wine courses this year and try to become a wine sommelier certified. I just want to put it in a paper, the knowledge I have. And it's a little scary, but definitely on a professional career, that's my next step. And also being capable of changing a little bit of the service way to do an omakase high-end restaurant in Japanese. Try to combine the French high-end service and the Japanese omotenashi kaiseki service and try to create a new counter omakase service. Because if we do French, then we'll be too technical in a way and we'll lose a little bit of that subtleness and beauty the omotenashi service, customer service Japanese will have. Mm. But if you do it completely Japanese, you end up missing that beautiful technique that the French develop for service in a high-end restaurant. So right now, for this year, we'll try to create a different type of service where you can combine friendliness and elegance, subtleness, omotenashi, everything, and do the omakase, sushi omakase service, high-end service. Yes.
Interesting. Yes. I don't think there are many places. I think at Sushi Nakazawa, I sensed that kind of, smooth flow of service physically and also reading your mind. And you offered something. You are that was in your mind before you asked for it. So that's the Japanese omotenashi.
Yes. Right.
Okay, great. So where can we find you online?
I'm Yuki Minakawa. Anywhere. So Yuki Minakawa, I'm on Facebook and also on Instagram. I do not have a specific social media for my work. This is basically my life in a way. I'm passionate with beverage, I'm passionate with food, I'm passionate with service, but I'm also passionate with animals. So yes, and just little throw my dream and my plan for the future is actually do a animal sanctuary.
Oh wow.
So if you go to my social media, you will see a lot of very amazing wines and sake and very high-end beverages and also food, but you see a lot of animals too.
Interesting. Okay, so and yeah, listen, I can of course go to Sesikinza Nodera and find you.
Yes, please, please. I'm there 5 days a week, so you can always come and see me, and mostly at dinner time.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Yuki.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
So keep me posted, and then we can do maybe more detailed pairing.
Yes, episode. Yes, definitely, definitely. It will be my pleasure to come back here and talk to you and your listeners.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikokatema.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.